Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 4th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is the presenter, Karen Bloomquist. Today's session number is 98-7, and it is titled, Towards Sufficient Sustainable Livelihood for All, Christian Conviction versus Economic Assumptions. Let's listen in.
Our second session I'm doing this week, but it's the one where we begin to especially focus in on this particular document towards sufficient sustainable livelihood for all, which, as it says in the cover, is the first draft of an ELCA social statement on economic life. As most of you, I think, are aware, I'm the director of the department in the ELCA through which the studies and statements on social issues are developed. And I thought this particular week, whether or not people here are ELCA members doesn't make any difference, but that it would be fun to use this document as a way of engaging in some conversation about the relationship between our Christian faith and some of not only the assumptions about the economy, which is what we're going to be talking about today, but the practices, the outcomes, the results. And therefore, that's what our conversation the rest of this week is going to be dealing with. Tomorrow, we will be looking at that word sufficiency and looking up at some of the sections in here that talk about that. And the next day on sustainability, and then the final day on for all. And if you do want to take this with you, you might want to just look it over, although homework is not anything you can ever prescribe here at Holden. But it might be helpful because we're really, the next 3 days especially, I'm really going to want to get lots of input and suggestions and comments from you, from out of your life situation, the kind of economic realities that you're aware of, etc. So I'm going to try to get us on the ground with this overall theme, and I'll be doing a little bit more of the talking today. But I can assure you the next 3 days, I especially want to get a lot of input from you and others in the village who participate in it. Let me begin by saying that there is probably no topic that is referred to so frequently throughout Scripture as are matters related to economic life. Now, that's usually not necessarily with the word economic in there, so we might not always recognize it, but when you think of the number of references to the rich and the poor, to matters of trade, of exchange, how a people organize their life together, how they treat those who are the poor in their midst, their material needs, a whole array of things that in one way or another are part of what we would associate with economic life. And Jim Wallace of Sojourners has been quoted as saying that if you try to cut out all the passages in just the New Testament that spoke about economic matters, the pages of Scripture would literally not hang together anymore. Because, you know, the allusions, the parables, all of the references, and that's just in the New Testament, and certainly in the Old Testament too. If anything, there's just as many references. So, in response to that opening introduction that was read from in the dining hall, I think it therefore is very clear that faith and economic life are not separate realms, but how we talk about our faith, how we live out our faith, has a lot of implications in terms of economic life. Some of the strongest words of judgment are, of course, against economic greed. If you read through parts of James, you know, the words are pretty scathing, and, there aren't a lot of those texts in James don't come up in our usual Sunday lectionaries, but if they do, a lot of preachers would be kind of hesitant to really preach on words, for example, like these. Come now, you rich people, weep and wail for the miseries that are coming to you, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields. Cry out, and cries of the harvesters have reached out to the Lord. Pretty angry kinds of words in Scripture that relate to economic life, and therefore, particularly in churches that are predominantly middle class or better, it's probably no wonder that we don't often hear those strong words. But even to take some of the very basic teachings that come to us, for example, about the Ten Commandments, and to understand what the meaning of to steal is, and to realize that one of the key understandings here, are there some more of the ones there? If some of you have come together, please share so we can pass the copies around here. But the whole notion of steal, if you look at it in portions of Scripture, is that to take away or withhold from others what they need to live as productive members of society is, in fact, a form of stealing. Various practices in the Old Testament called for redistributing resources and restoring land to those who had lost it during hard times, especially some of the rather obscure passages in Leviticus that we don't always know what to make of some of them. And then finally, the very root meaning of economy, the Greek roots of that word have to do with the management of the household. And I think for our purposes as Christians, thinking of that household being the whole household of God throughout the whole world. And so I think just, you know, a matter of saying, let's look at the origin of that very word. Now, most of the time when we hear about economics, that's not what immediately comes to mind, and yet that's what the root word of it is all about. Now, some might say, why should the church be addressing economic matters now? After all, most of the economic signs couldn't be better. Although earlier this evening I was looking at the New York Times and second quarter went down a little bit, so it wasn't quite as glowing as some of the recent indicators have been. And the stock market, though, still seems to be zooming. Unemployment, at least in this country, is at record lows. We don't have to look far to see where it's different. I was looking at the Vancouver paper and realized in British Columbia the unemployment rate is 10%. Much different from the 4.3% we have here in the United States. And the pronouncements of Alan Greenspan, our national high priest, have the power to affect overnight shifts in economic indicators that almost make biblical miracles pale by comparison. Indeed, many people are doing fairly well economically, but that's why I think we need to be concerned, because those glowing positive signs can fool us into not seeing those who are not making it economically. And I think as people of faith, we are called to see economic realities, especially as they affect those who aren't benefiting from some of that economic activity, who suffer, who despair, and who lack what is needed to live a decent life. I'm talking here not only about people in this country, but certainly also about the two-thirds of the world that continues to live in poverty. And of those, the 1 billion who, according to Bread for the World statistics, live in abject poverty, very much a hand-to-mouth kind of existence. In this country, income disparity between those at the very top and those in the bottom continues to grow. And it may grow even more with some of the current policies that are being put into effect in Washington and elsewhere. Chief executive officers of the major U.S. companies, a year or so ago, the statistics were that they were receiving compensation that is 200 times that of the average worker, which is a far greater disparity than any other industrialized country. I mean, it's many times more. And I think that whole huge disparity, that, you know, the compensation, including not just the salary, but, you know, all the various stock options and all the benefits and all the extra perks in addition to that. Globally, the richest one-fifth hold 83% of the total income and even more of the total wealth. I think along with these concerns related to the disparity is in this country, and I think to some degree in some other countries, I've heard some of the same is going on in parts of Canada, that assumptions about the proper role of government in assuring that the needs of the poorest are met have in recent years been ridiculed and in some cases demolished. And we don't have welfare as we used to have it. And even though I think a case can be made for how the system we did have had some real problems to it, I think we do need to ask some serious questions as people of faith of what happens to the least in our midst when that institution that is especially understood theologically as having a role in protecting the common good is increasingly being ridiculed, and you know, you put in a good word for government, and you know, you're immediately told that you're kind of out of date. I think, though, the main reason, and these are all part of the reason why I think we need to be addressing economic life, but one of the main reasons that it is so urgent is because the global economy, and the economy we live in today is a global economy. Decisions made here affect the rest of the globe. The rest of what happens in other parts of the globe affect us here. In a lot of ways, there really isn't a, quote, domestic economy anymore. But the global economy and what it demands have become a kind of reigning religion in our world today. A free-running economic system that is reordering the world without checks, and it's the only system around. Through the 80s, there was, you know, continuing debates of, well, you know, capitalism versus socialism and different ways of ordering a society economically. But that's no longer the case. The global market economy is kind of the reigning power in the world today. And I think it's dangerous whenever any kind of economic system can acquire that kind of godlike feeling in terms of how it operates and in ways that you know, critiquing or challenging what's going on are often ruled out of order. Mm-hmm. And I pose that because I think we're dealing here with what is a deeply religious, theological kind of issue. I put the title and author of one book up there, Robert Simon's Competing Gods. I'll say a little bit more in just a few minutes about his thesis, but I think that, or Competing Gospels is the title of his, but he, I think, poses it in that matter of it being kind of competing faiths. And therefore, what we who come out of a Jewish and Christian kind of tradition can recognize is that is really a situation of idolatry. We face the deeply theological issue of the competing gods, the God we confess through our creeds on Sunday morning versus the God of the global economy who demands ever more sacrifices from those who have little to begin with. The seduction of the global economy has turned more and more societies into societies where what matters is accumulation of wealth as power based on an ever-expanding exchange of commodities. You might recall that familiar scenario in Exodus 32, where Aaron commanded the people to take off their golden rings, to melt them, and he melted them and formed them into an image of the calf and said to the people, "These are your gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And the people, quote, brought sacrifices of well-being, unquote. That story somehow struck me when, about a year and a half ago, I happened to just drop in on an event, and I really felt like an interloper, but it was one of these kind of mind-boggling kinds of experiences. I live in Chicago on the edge of the University of Chicago campus. And as some of you are probably aware, University of Chicago proudly boasts of being the home of Nobel laureates, especially in economics, than anywhere in the world. And in many ways, the economists that have come out of there have really shaped the global economy. And there was going to be some big forum on law and economics, and I could see that three out of the four in this panel were people who had, you know, won Nobels. And I thought, well, it'd be kind of interesting to see who these guys are anyway. So I went in this big law school auditorium. Actually, my husband was with me, and we both felt just very much out of place. Because you look down, you know, a sloping auditorium, and there on the stage, draped with the maroon velvet of the University of Chicago, was this big, long table. I mean, kind of the high altar. This huge banner of the university behind them. And there sit these four men plus the moderator. And the event had started already. Just the visual effect of this was one of the high altar of the gods. And then they start talking, and very much free market, you know, the unquestioned truths of free market theory. And then I really felt like, you know, I was in a foreign religion at that point. And then there was one, they started getting off on a little humorous note, and they were talking about how this one subspecialty of economics was kind of out of touch with what was really going on in the real world. Of course, they said, "We don't want people to know this," but, and then they went on, they said, "Yeah, before long, we'll be as archaic and out of touch with the real world as divinity schools have been for centuries." It was really the kind of juxtaposition of those images and then that reference. It just, you know, it was probably a strong and motivating experience to say, why is it that there's some clashes here between, you know, what I feel are important theological premises that we as people of faith need to operate with, and the kind of language that was going on there was just, you know, a totally different kind of world. A couple of other things, and then we'll get into this document. The journalist William Grider, in his book One World Ready or Not, which I also have listed up here, spends nearly 500 pages describing disturbing examples of what's happening around the world today through the ruthless dealings of the globalized economy. And he concludes with this rather stark commentary. "The utopian vision of the marketplace offers, after all, an enthralling religion." And remember, this is not a theologian speaking. This is a secular journalist. "But the marketplace offers this enthralling religion, a self-satisfied belief system that attracts fervent and influential adherents. The wondrous machine of free-running enterprise has fantastic capabilities, and people defer to its powers, persuaded it will carry them forward to millennial powers. abstracted from human reality, the market's intricate mechanisms convey an entrancing sense of perfection, logical and self-correcting. Many intelligent people have come to worship these market principles like a spiritual code that will resolve all the larger questions for us, social and moral and otherwise, so long as no one interferes with its authority. In this modern secular age, many who think of themselves as rational and urbane have put their faith in this idea of the self-regulating market as piously as others put their trust in God. That's kind of the concluding sentence of this 500-page book, where he has literally gone all around the world to surface example after example of the intricacies of how the global economy is operating. But especially that idea of putting their faith in the market as others have put their trust in God. I mean, he really poses it as two alternatives. Robert Simons, in competing Gospels, describes how the original household understanding of economy focused on what could be used by the household rather than on what we can economically gain. With the rise of market economy thinking, people's motive for economic activity changed from producing what was needed into monetary transactions for the sake of individual gain. The market becomes the yardstick for measuring value, or what it is that really matters. Human needs become reduced to wants, which become infinite and insatiable. You always want more. Pleasure-seeking, atomistic individuals enter into market exchanges to serve their individual choices, and any choice will do. Such an economic model of choice, of course, overlooks that many live in life situations where they perceive they have few, if any, choices. Now, I think one of the reasons it's difficult for us as church to talk about economic life, especially when it begins to turn to the topic of money, is because money is a more taboo subject than almost anything, including sex. One book I'm reading here at Holden, Robert Wuthnow, who's a sociologist, done a lot of writing on the church. His book, Poor Richard's Principle, it's a kind of contemporary assessment of the place of work and money in American society. I'm not through it, so I can't tell you all about the book, but he, I think, makes a very persuasive point that the most taboo topic is money. You know, you really don't want to let on how much, you know, if you're middle class, if you're white middle class, you don't want to talk about it. He talks about how other racial ethnic groups or working class or poorer people that may not have quite the taboo topic, but those of us who have something, it's not, you know, we don't want to really let on how much we might have, and therefore it becomes a kind of taboo topic.
One of the problems, of course, for the middle class is that we're all involved in the system. We all can own stocks.
That's right.
And the churches all own stocks with pension funds, and yep. So we're so much a part of it, we don't want to criticize it.
That's right. And I think that's exactly why, you know, and this will carry over into the forum discussion, too, the whole matter of, you know, where do you say no when you find yourself so caught up in this, and it's not that clear cut, because we are beneficiaries of much of this. And you're right, I think it's just been in the last few years that we've reached the point We're now, the majority of the adult U.S. population is invested in the stock market. I mean, for many of us, that may only be the pension funds. But if one, you know, counts all that in, the majority of it's just slightly over the majority. And that's a huge change from a generation ago. And I think not only are we so caught up in it, as you've said, but I think it also then becomes this, how in the world do we get a hold of it? And therefore, it's easier just to say, oh, don't bother me with that. But I think for some in our churches, there still is that feeling of, church better just stay away from this. At the beginning of this process of working on the social statement, we had listening posts in different places of the country. I want to just say a word about two of those. One was in suburban New Jersey, and it was intentionally a gathering of members of our church, some congregation, ELCA congregations in that area, who are really some of the movers and shakers on Wall Street, and who are heavily, you know, involved in some pretty higher echelons of international business and finance. One of the members of our task force from this area, who himself is very much involved in international business consultation, came to that. He saw I was all ready to, you know, talk high-level stuff with these people. And instead, it ended up being a bearing of their souls in terms of their talking about what it really meant for them as people of faith to struggle with this and to be in the midst of all of this. I mean, it was an extraordinarily candid discussion. You know, we heard things I never quite expected to hear. And it was in a congregation where these struggles were regularly talked about. So we weren't coming in as strangers and just opening up a conversation. But this was a regular part of what they processed in and through their congregation. A very different kind of experience was in the Pittsburgh area, and that reference is important for the image. Comment of one of the men who was very clear about telling us that he handles $75 billion of people's money each year. His comment was, the global economy today is like a big steel ball rolling down the hill, and nothing can be done to stop it, and the church should let it just roll down the hill. Then he finally conceded, well, maybe the church should essentially minister to some of the victims of the steel wall after the fact. But, you know, it's like, it's coming down the hill, and you just get out of the way, and that's the way it is. And, you know, whether it's fate or whatever, you know, the church shouldn't raise any questions about what's going on, other than ministering to those who are affected by it. So I think those are just two examples of, I think, two different ways for those who are very much involved in the middle of what's happening in the global economy and their reactions as to how the faith should or should not be involved, or how people of faith should or should not be involved in this. So I think it's because of this sense of it feeling inevitable, as if it's not controlled by human decisions and actions, but that it is natural, of fate, of God, part of a dynamic, natural evolution. It's those ways of thinking about what's going on in the economy that I think should wake us as people of faith up to the fact that, hey, there's something deeply theological going on here that is somewhat different from what it is that we confess, and therefore there's a real competing faith kind of thing going on here. I want to get into this particular document, but let's just hear some responses, questions, clarifications, expressions of doubt or whatever in relationship to some of what I've been laying forward. Bill?
I was just curious if the group that had bared their soul, so to speak, did they have the kind of same opinion of the same metaphor of the ball rolling downhill, or did they have some ideas or things that...
As I recall, this was like 5 years ago, so I'm a little fuzzy. I think it was a little frustrating because they were feeling kind of helpless in the middle of it, too. Even though they were aware that they were in the place of making decisions that could significantly affect a lot of people's lives. And therefore there was a real humility of, hey, you know, I'm aware that these decisions can have enormous repercussions. And of course they were, feeling, well, you know, we've got to be in competition, we've got to scramble like everything to make the next quarter profit, and if we don't, who knows what will happen to us or what will happen to our company vis-a-vis the Japanese company that we're in competition with. Again, this was 5 years ago. It might have been a different country they might have referred to in 1999. There wasn't, I think as they began to talk together, one could see some seeds of resistance or some at least having some sounding board there through their congregation. But quite frankly, as one of them who was almost in tears as he said, hey, you know, I can't talk about this with any of the people in the company I work with. And yet in the church there somehow was a place to begin to raise some moral ethical questions in the midst of it. So it wasn't quite as hopeful as I wished it had been. But it was still a different posture than just saying, you can't do anything about it.
You probably think about this all the time, that how politics has got overtaken by this, and it seemed to be so out of balance that the money, the interests, seem to be able to weaken environmental laws and safety laws, you know, really with very little effort, it looks like to me. And, you know, and somehow I see it as our own fault, you know, for letting this happen. Because even the United States, with all of its faults, you know, the machinery is there to do the right thing if you have the will to do the right thing. And it seems like we don't have the will to do the right thing.
I think we, I'm glad you brought in government or, you know, the political process, because I think you're right. And that's why it is the global economy that in so many arenas is really calling the shots. You know, when you think of a lot of decisions that are being made, and here, you know, this isn't partisan politics. I think Republican or Democrat, you know, the way in which what will serve our economic interests becomes the bottom line of so much of the decision making that's going on these days. And so, you know, what should be some kind of a countervailing force in all of this, not to mention the fact that GM, of course, they've now been going through all their turmoil right now, but the economic activity they generate is far greater than the gross domestic product of a whole bunch of nations. And, you know, like Scandinavian and some other,
That could be even
scale.
Considered a good thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with economic activity. It's your point is corrupt
But there's no accountability.
Right.
I mean, it's just, bottom line.
Well, we're all in favor of jobs and economic, all of us want a nice retirement and all that kind of.
Yeah, and that's why, and certainly this particular draft is not one of saying, well, let's just forget about economic activity. Because if we're serious, if we're realistic about livelihood, and that sufficient sustainable livelihood for all is consistent with what we understand to be God's intent for creation, that therefore means, that happens through market exchanges, through the economy. So it's a mixture, it's the good and the bad. That's in a sense another version of what was said over here, namely that, we're in the midst of it. You know, this isn't the kind of thing where we can stand outside and say, oh, well, we're not a part of this economic system. I don't think any of us would be able to even get here at Holden if we weren't participants in it to a considerable degree.
And I had kind of had this wish that in economic cycles, you don't come and go, and they always happen, that if when there gets to be some kind of downturn, there'll be momentum going in the direction you're saying, just like there's momentum going this way now as things are going so good. I mean, that's, am I being naive?
I think you are. I think you really are, because I think the system is, you set the clue. We produce that profit is the do-all of everything, not need. We have made the switch. We do not produce because people have needs, and we don't produce those things that people need. We produce those things that we have now manipulated people to want, and we make sure they're things that have to be replaced. I remember years ago, was it Alec Guinness? There was a movie, The Man with the White Suit or something, where he invented a cloth that would never wear out, and the whole world was against him because it would destroy this economic system. And boy, that was a long time ago before all this was even, anyway, I think the shift is that we no longer see that we work with our hands or our factories or our machines to produce the things that people need, but only those things to make profit from.
Well, and the speculative exchanges too.
Yes,
and
in a different world.
It's a huge thing in terms of. But let's get into this document a little bit. Those of you who have access to a copy of it, turn to page 3. I'm going to very quickly make reference to the bolded items on pages, from the bottom of page 3 through page 6. We may not get through all of those in the less than half an hour we have left. But I want to claim that these are, I think, some of the convictions that we as people of faith need to not only live into, but live more deeply into, in terms of seeing how this raises some challenges to what's going on economically. I guess I've, you know, in terms of the last two comments, I kind of waver between your comments, because as you can see in here, I think as people of faith, there's reason for us to be hopeful in the midst of it, not naive about the prospects of this changing. But and it's, I don't think just people who share our faith convictions will make some of those changes happening. But I think there are some signs of hope where there are people who are saying, hey, we're concerned about what's happening to our community, about our family, about our relationships in the name of economic growth or economic profit. And I think there are some sites of resistance where some of that is happening. And I think part of what we need to do is find ways to raise those up where we see those happening. Let's just go through some of these. First of all, on line 31 of page 3, we are created in community. The whole biblical understanding is a much more social, relational understanding of who human beings are than tends to be the assumption operating in the economy. Which is that we are, you know, individual, self-seeking, etc., autonomous human beings. But that whole notion that we are nurtured and sustained through the inner relationships of community. Economic life should enhance and not jeopardize this life in community. You think of an example where that understanding is violated, where something quite different is going on in economic life?
In the key of doors.
An example of me that fits this is advertising in the public school system, or a company will come in and donate money for the football team or for facilities. you know, but their name goes up as a way of advertising on the public property.
So in a sense, they're...
Some people take issue to that, some people don't. It's an issue in some communities. Or even having Coke machines in the hallway in a school, or Pepsi versus Pepsi or something.
You can make the opposite argument too, but that enhances life in the community.
Yeah, yeah. I think a company is saying we're going to make a contribution there, even though we could then somewhat cynically saying, well, yeah, they're getting some free advertising or mm-hmm. or whatever there too. How about another example?
The maquiladoras on the, like, down in Mexico, people working for literally a dollar a day or whatever to put together, to assemble products.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about community, the pressure that, whether it's one or two breadwinners in the family feel about what job they have, and either having to look for another job because of different things in another community. My son has his best friend of 6 years ago, his dad has moved three times in 6 years. Mm-hmm. And both grew up in Connecticut. They don't live in Connecticut now. Mm-hmm. He was working with GE and wanted to get away from being always away from home. So he went mm-hmm. to another job. That didn't pan out. He went to another job. And our mobile society doesn't encourage community at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good example of how it's just, you know, you are needed for this company to be here, and whatever relational matrix that is key to who you are and that gives your life meaning. Yeah, I mean, certainly that's a strong kind of thing in terms of a lot of rural farming communities. And when that somehow becomes devastating.
On the boat, on the way up, I was talking to a woman who was talking about the position of migrant laborers mm-hmm. in this part of the country, mm-hmm. come in to pick fruit. Mm-hmm. And she told me about many times people have no dwellings. They have to live in the woods. Mm-hmm. Because people who own the orchards don't feel that they can provide that, that it's not economically feasible for them to provide that. Mm-hmm. So there's a real struggle on many different fronts.
And that example of, you know, what happens to the farm laborers, I know at least the ELCA in Oregon, that scene has been very actively, are any of you from Oregon? Has been very involved in the task forces related to those who farm the land, and taking some strong advocacy positions on that. Okay, let's just move on to some of these, because I think there's a number of accents here that help us see where this tension is between our faith and economics. On the top of page 4, we're called to be stewards, to respect the integrity and the limits of the earth and its resources. I suppose the big symbol of all that is always the tailings that we visibly see here at Holden. Biblical perspectives challenge any tendency to view the earth's resources as property humans have an absolute right to possess or use however they choose. How un-American. Well, that's mine. I'm going to do with that piece of land whatever I want to.
The only thing that I might say about that is, you know, coming from an agriculture state of North Dakota, which is a long way from a lot of you, I think even our colleges and universities have not taken the time to do research to take care of the land and grow products at the same time. It's been research driven for a particular reason and paid for by a company to produce a product to produce more, not necessarily better, but more for less money, or so that they can sell a product rather than what's good for the land. Because every time we change one element, we change many elements as it goes along. Mm-hmm. And I don't think our universities or the education side of it think about that, because they are also thinking about how do I create dollars or do grant work or things like that.
They're often doing grant work for institutions that go counter to that. Weyerhaeuser supports University of Washington with a lot of dollars, and you don't see much research coming out of there in terms of supporting forestry practices in this state, for instance.
It was interesting, again, in these 94 listing posts, one in South Dakota, and somebody with the Extension Service, you know, really had to confide, you know, what it is that he's expected to tell. He wasn't on the research end so much as the broadcast part. What he's supposed to tell farmers, you know, basically bigger and bigger and bigger is the answer. Mm-hmm. He says, morally, I know that's not right. But he says, well, that's what I'm expected to say. You know, so a different, yeah. A little different. But
it's that same context, that's right. Or, you know, we can't, everything's got to be bigger. Something that came up to me this winter that I hadn't thought about before is the people that produce more and believe more and more is better make somewhat fun of the Amish people. But yet the Amish people pay cash for their land when they buy it from their parents, and they don't, and if their land comes available close to their Amish community, they go out and pay cash for it. Mm-hmm. Now they made a conscious decision never to use machinery to produce crops or products. They might use some machinery, but they never use the tractor because it replaced people, and that was a conscious decision. Yet they make do different things that make money that makes them cash available. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need to sometimes change our paradigm to think differently than just with equipment or with machines.
So those are good points. And especially when we get into the sustainability issue, we're going to want to, I think, pursue that further. The next paragraph, work that meets basic needs. I'm not going to say a lot about that right now. We'll talk about that more later. But then the relationships of daily bread. Some of you may be familiar with this document, which was the study that came before this first draft. And as you can see, it has the title, Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread. There's a few copies of this left for sale in the bookstore, by the way. And in that, one of the things we try to do is to set forth Luther's expanded notion of what daily bread entails. That's not just Luther, but we thought, well, we'll draw somebody from our own tradition. And there's a real sense in which he had an appreciation for this whole network of relationships and institutions that are a part of assuring that we will have what we need to live. And you know, through family, business, government, nonprofit organizations, etc., our lives are sustained and livelihood made possible. So when we pray, give us this day our daily bread, this is kind of a continuation of yesterday's homily, but you know, that should also evoke a sense of the fact that we're not just talking about, you know, who is it that gave me this bread, but what are all the relationships, what are all the processes that are part of that, not just for bread, but for all the other things that we need in order to live. That next paragraph, I want to dwell on just a little bit, because I've said already that I think kill and steal have a much broader understanding in Scripture than we typically think of. We say, oh well, I didn't go out and kill anybody today and I didn't steal anything. When you read, for example, Luther's explanation, especially in the Large Catechism, you discover that none of us, you know, we all end up being guilty. In other words, it's a very expanded notion. I got a phone call about 3 weeks ago from a woman in the Twin Cities who is on SSI, who's been, you know, has been living with disabilities most of her adult life. And she said, you know, I'm getting into this document. I mean, at first she was concerned because she thought we were saying, well, everybody should be self-sufficient. I said, no, this is not quite saying that. But then she went on and she said, you know, I really have been thinking about what it says in there about stealing. because she said, the way it is, I have to spend on every, you know, all this money that I have in order to get the meager SSI payments that I have. And she said, you know, it kind of feels like the government is stealing from me before they then turn around and say, well, we'll give you a little bit. So she got in this whole thing of understanding that and saying, you know, we make people who are in need, you know, be just absolute paupers before we even begin to help them. She said, isn't that a form of the government stealing, which I thought was it? So she ended up having this conversation on the phone. And the idea that you are killing if you do not help and support your neighbor in all life's need. This is kind of going back to the catechism and saying, what does that really say? And what does that, where are the implications of that for how we live out our economic life? All of page 5, I think it is to me the heart of the matter when we talk about where in the world do we find the power, the possibility of saying no to some of what's going on in the global economy. First of all, what is laid out there is a notion of sin, not so much as individual acts, but that sense of living as if our ultimate trust is in someone or something other than God. Refusing to accept limits, endless accumulation, and the way in which that in turn distorts human life, human dignity. The final sentence, line 13, sin leads to increasing suspicion of others, distrust of institutions, and cynicism regarding prospects for change. That, however, is not the end of the story. And I think it's at that point that we need to discover more deeply what it means to talk about God's inbreaking reign. If in fact God is more powerful than these forces, what does it mean to live out of that vision? To be, as it were, partners with God in our challenging of some of what's going on. Here's where a phrase that I've long remembered from having been a student of Dorothea Zola's. She has in one of her books the notion that faith is the struggle against objective cynicism. In other words, when we just feel that it's totally hopeless, totally powerless, faith is that hanging in there when everything seems stacked against us, when this huge ruling power of the global economy seems to just be like a bulldozer or like a steel ball overtaking everything. What does it mean to live out of that basic kind of faith conviction?
And there's it. Things that I've thought about when I've been here is I've lived here for 6 weeks in the winter on a program for artists, and something that impressed or made an impact on me, there were two things. First of all, being from Southern California, the snow and just the different environment, but also living in community. There are about 75 people here, and I was here long enough to experience how it was that when you're living in Holden Village, you can't buy much. You can go to the bookstore, and that's it. And there are people who've committed here for 2 or 3 years. And I've been thinking in the last several days that it really, I would think, would be interesting for everyone here to strike up conversations with people who live here for 2 or 3 years and say, how is it to live here and just not be able to buy things? How does that affect your spirit, you know, your worldview?
Are there some long-term staff people here who can want to make a comment on that?
Kathy lived here much longer.
Well, I've lived here for 9 months, and I guess I haven't really I've never really been into buying things, so it was very nice, like supportive to live in a community where no one really could, no one really complained against not going to the mall that weekend or something, and it's like you're really living pure life, no distractions or
not having to buy food, which is a big item.
Nobody even checking your meal ticket when you come in the dining hall.
I can save quite a bit of money by coming up here and working because I'm not there, I'm not home to spend any money.
That's true.
And it's beneficial for me economically to volunteer up here.
And yet you don't, you feel that your needs are being satisfied at the same time.
Yes, right.
That's one of the thoughts I was having. You know, one of the things that this points up to me is complacency of our economic system. You know, we Americans don't need to get out there and rattle the world economy very much. You know, for the most part, the world is coming to us, but that ain't going to be that way very much longer. You know, with the Japanese economy struggling now, but you know, there's the looming giant of China out there that looks clearly, all right, we need to be thinking very clearly about how we're going to fit into this global economy, because we're going to be playing second fiddle pretty quickly until at least standards of living in another part of the world is working on the system that they're working on right now, you know, catches up. So it seems to me that's a lot of what I'm getting from this, is that it's time for us to not be so complacent in our economic vision of our lives, and that the church needs to speak to that.
Well, yeah, and also, but I also want to make sure that, and we'll get into the for all phrase later. I mean, part of it is, you know, the perspective that we view our economic, how do we need to see that in a global perspective too? And the fact that to some degree, to a large degree, it's not any national government, be it the US, Japan, China, or whatever, that's increasingly calling the shots, but it's the power of these large global corporations that are transnational, and that it can significantly affect the livelihood within a given country.
But it's not been our mindset.
Pardon?
It's not been on our mindset that's...
That's right. I mean, we've assumed, well, gee, you know, we're a sovereign nation. But I think even the notion of national sovereignty, at least in terms of economic self-determination, is to a large degree being threatened by some of these large forces. And I don't want to, and the part of the reason I brought in this listening post of these people in New Jersey is I don't want us to go away from this session kind of demonizing the global economy. I mean, we're talking about human beings, many of whom are trying to live out their faith through their, you know, in their vocations, in these positions, etc. And so it's not just a matter of throwing stones at the global economy, but how do we get in that? And see, that's where I think also some theological understandings that relate to sin and the fact that the sin is this sense of domination and entrapment. Now, somehow in the midst of that, you know, there's not just sin, but there's grace, and there's, you know, there's hope in the midst of that. But there's a profound depth of analysis that our own theological understandings can you know, that we can draw upon in terms of how we understand and make some sense of this and say, yeah, therefore, as people of faith, there is a possibility of challenging some of these practices. Let me just conclude by pointing out that on page 6, there's a number of themes here related to You know, those of us who have been freed for neighbor love to seek God's justice in the world are called to work for what is listed here as three forms of justice, pages 20 or lines 26 and following. Productive justice, using what we have in order to be productive in human community. Yeah, we are called to work, to participate in God's creation. Secondly, distributive justice, which seeks fairness in how income and wealth are distributed or allocated among people. And thirdly, participatory justice. People should be involved in the processes by which decisions are made that affect them and their livelihood. So this is clearly saying, yeah, it's not just a matter of people being given what they have, but being able to participate, having some decision-making role in that too. And that it's all three together that are a part of at least how justice is being talked about in what follows and in some of the criteria that we'll be getting into the subsequent kinds of days. So I think as people of faith, just to conclude, it's not that we're naive about the possibility of countering a lot of this, but at the same time, we live out of God's promise. And at the core of what that biblical promise is all about is that there be sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all. So what we're going to want to talk about is how do we move toward that vision? And what does that kind of benchmark vision imply for what we here and now are called to do? Not that we can naively assume that somehow we're going to bring in the kingdom, but you know, as God's people, how might we live so that the economy begins to, in places and in ways, come a bit closer to what we understand to be God's intent for the whole of creation, for the whole household of God. So, thank you for coming, and was indicated in the announcements, I think another variation on what we've been talking about this hour will be a part of our discussion during the forum after Vespers, so I encourage any of you to come back.